Welcome, listeners. Welcome to our humble podcast as we gather around by the fireside, hear the crackling of logs. You will notice that there is an empty chair huddled here in the high-backed leather, cracked green leather armchair. There is merely a shadow where Ben Everard used to be and should be and will be next fortnight, but he's not here now. So instead, we will soldier on without him. Me, that is, Andrew, James, Gregory, and you,
Graham MacDonald Morrison.
And you there in the middle.
And me is Mike Colonel Saunders.
Yes. Together, we three will somehow bimble on and record this, that is Series 5, Episode 8 of the Linux Voice podcast. Still to come, we've got news, we've got discoveries, we've got Vocalize Your Neurons, perhaps, maybe not. Mike is looking blank, as ever. and we also have the voice of the masses. I intermittently will break off to enjoy my potato, bacon, leek and spinach surprise, which I knocked up for myself a mere 5 minutes ago on returning home from the pub. I may have to leave off to strangle the dog if he starts barking, but apart from that, we have ahead of us an unalloyed, unadulterated circa 45 minutes of Linux japery. If you like the sound of which, you can subscribe to Linux Magazine at shop.linuxnewmedia.com/subs. There you will find our words, our graven words, written in stone, like so much, oh, I don't know, just good words. So, Graham, it's you.
And I'm going to pass you straight on to Mike.
Hi. Yes.
I love the efficiency.
Delegation, you see. Ben isn't here, and I don't look like Ed Sheeran, but I'm going to try and do a decent job. And in fact, we always say the podcast should be 45 minutes, and then it's longer, so I think that's Ben's fault. So I'll try and get through the news a bit more quickly. First off in the news this episode is that Canonical appears to be on the path towards an IPO, and was initial public offering. So we talked about this in the last podcast, that Canonical is changing direction with Ubuntu, less focus on the desktop, no more Unity. Have they cancelled Mir? Is Mir out of the window?
I think so. You've put me on the spot there. I think they're maintaining Mir because it's used in some embedded devices. But certainly, okay. I think the investment in these things, Unity and Mir, has been drastically reduced.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked about this back, like, I think it was the last episode, and, you know, quite a major change. Ubuntu is probably the biggest desktop distribution, but Mark Shuttleworth, Canonical founder and all-round benevolent dictator, said this is part of putting the company on the path to an IPO. We must figure out what steps we need to take moving forward. So I don't know anything about finance or IPOs or IPAs, actually.
In a very basic, simple level, it means that it's no longer, you know, a privately owned company run by Mark and the CEO and the board members. You know, the company has public shares that, and the shareholders have actually. Running the company for the benefit of the shareholders becomes the number one priority.
So that in itself could influence how Ubuntu develops.
That's the P in IPO, initial public offering.
And I think that's a different question. I mean, to go to what Mike's saying about whether that would change what Canonical does and how it changes what it does, I don't know whether it would change the face of Ubuntu. I've seen the discussions today. I mean, it's difficult because I work for Canonical, but I mean, these rumors, I think it's worth saying that rumors of a Canonical IPO have been circulating for years, 10 years. Yeah. And I think it's this.
Since they started, really.
Yeah. And this comes at a time, I think, so at the moment I watched the video of Mark Shuttleworth talking at the OpenStack Summit. It's currently the OpenStack Summit. And I think it's very obvious that Ubuntu Canonical has seen, has refocused on cloud and Internet of Things. These are the things that it sees as its greatest opportunities. That this is the kind of thing Mark was saying at the OpenStack Summit. And I think that that makes complete sense. You know, they. I mean, I really don't want to sound like a salesman, but Ubuntu is the operating system that's used more than any other on the cloud, and public cloud and private cloud, for on OpenStack deployments and in Internet of Things. So I think it's more Canonical trying to. This is, you know, this has only really happened in the last 8 years. You know,
doesn't Amazon? Does Amazon use Ubuntu in its Amazon Web Services?
Well, yes, the Ubuntu is the most popular cloud that people spin up with Amazon's web services. It's because, you know, I think that's, I'm talking totally personally, it's because of the ubiquity of Ubuntu, the fact that we all got on with it, it lets you just get on with stuff. There's a whole generation of Linux users out there who got started with Ubuntu. And so when they took their knowledge to the cloud and they started hacking around with OpenStack and deploying things with AWS, when they came down to an OS to choose, they just span up Ubuntu server. And I think this is, you know, this is increasingly Canonical recognizing that usage and trying to turn it into its business.
So again, bearing in mind that I am so financially unknowledgeable, even if unknowledgeable is a word, which it probably isn't, what would Canonical get or gain from having an IPO? Because as well as having a bunch of busybodies meddling in your business plans, which I guess happens when you have shareholders, what do they get? A short-term cash boost?
It would be a huge cash boost. And I mean, totally, not talking about Canonical specifically, an IPO kind of frees the owner and whoever's running the company to maybe, you know, not make it their full-time. Well, it may be, sometimes it's part of the deal that the CEO or the owner has to stay on for a couple of years, but also it could signify change in direction or change of emphasis for the owner.
Yeah, they get a massive injection of cash in exchange for losing some control.
Okay.
But when you buy into, if you're an institutional investor and you buy into an IPO, then you have an idea of the market and where you want that company to go. So you try to exert some sort of control over whatever company it is, for example, Canonical. So if you think that Canonical has made a mistake in abandoning convergence, you can buy a squillion pounds worth of shares and get on the board and say, we must invest in convergence.
You sort of buy your influence. We do have a fourth person in the podcast, after all. Well, from what Andrew said, I know a pretty cool guy who's working for Canonical. So, yeah, I think I would invest in them in an IPO. Hello, Begbie. In which case, on that bombshell of dog-related antics, let's move on to the second of my three news stories. And that is Fedora will get full support for MP3 audio files, because IIS Fraunhofer is terminating the MP3 licensing program. So I think the patents on MP3 have expired. MP3 has been around for at least a billion years. We all know that a lot of Linux distributions had problems supporting MP3 out of the box. Because of this, Ubuntu, I don't think, played MP3s out of the box for a while, or maybe still doesn't, and people installed Mint, which had all this codec support. So on the one hand, it's quite a nice boost that distros will be able to support MP3 format straight away. On the other hand, how much do people use MP3s now anyway? Is everybody on FLAC and, I don't know,
Ogg Vorbis?
Opus, as we use for the podcast.
Yeah, I wonder how many. I haven't checked to see how many people download the Opus version recently. Og Vorbis is used by Spotify for its streaming quality, for its music streaming. So the codec certainly exists. This has been a long time coming. I mean, I can't believe MP3 was. It was part of, you know, a video specification. It was used by people to compress audio at a time when it took you half an hour to download a single song and you couldn't store more than 10 on a device. It's remarkable that it's, I don't know, they'd say the guy that wrote the algorithm has been able to pivot and make such exceptional use of his work. The fact that it's, has that spurred on innovation? Probably not. It's very similar to the kind of the MPEG-4 codecs and the patents that, you know, protect those. The fact that Fedora and free distributions can now play MP3 music is a really important step. But it's you know, that is because there's legislation to protect against extended use of patents for exactly this reason.
Yeah, like you say, MP3 is really old. I remember downloading MP3s, totally legally, I'm sure, back in the day on a dial-up connection.
Yeah,
that's when I had a Real Player as well. God. Do you remember Real Player?
Well, that's it. Blatantly. I mean, yeah, MP3 was so much better than Real Audio, wasn't it?
It was, but Real Audio at the time, when I had a terrible modem dial-up connection from Northern England, I could still listen to like radio stations all across the world, which, you know, at the time was just mind-blowing. Today, we just take it for granted. But, you know, firing up Real Player and tuning into some, you know, Far Eastern radio, like, wow, I'm listening to stuff from the other side of the world, and, like 2 kilobytes a second, terrible quality, but it made things like that possible. But yeah, so we've got free distros will now have MP3 support. What else do we need? CSS for DVDs? I guess that's a bit of a thorny issue.
Yeah, I guess that's going to be protected by the US DMCA legislation that doesn't allow you to circumvent copy protection, despite the fact, you know, I don't know if people have been stopped going through airports with the DCSS code on their T-shirts.
It's so cool that you could compress it down to like some Perl statement and have the whole thing on your T-shirt. What's the situation like with Blu-rays and Linux these days?
I you know something, I don't know. I haven't got an optical drive in my computer. I know that software like Handbrake supports the reading and ripping of Blu-rays and encoding them in suitably open formats. I see that people do it. People use it to add their collections legitimately to NAS boxes so that they don't have to keep swapping discs. But it's not something I've been interested in for quite a long time. But yeah, I mean, I guess with many distributions like Ubuntu actually just paid to include the codec. So MP3 playback work for them, but I think it's really important that this has become properly free software and a free implementation that everybody can use.
I think a lot of distros used to circumvent it, didn't they? Just by, as soon as you installed it, there was a little pop-up box saying, do you want to install MP3s? It's at your own risk.
Yeah.
And Click yes to do so.
I think it
so everybody ended up using it.
Yeah. And I think there was that geographical division where US patent legislation was much more strict than European patent legislation, which meant that you could install manually the MP3 codecs, you know, and if you did that, then the distributions could even provide a repository or a command that lets you do that. You know, the non-free parts of the software of the distribution you could install after you'd installed the distro.
I just want to give a random shout out to a piece of software that I haven't used in years, probably over 10, 15 years. But it was an MP3 player for Linux called MP3 Blaster. And it was a command line thing, but it was the only thing that would play MP3s on my 33 megahertz Toshiba satellite, I think laptop, some second-hand laptop I picked up back in, must be early, very early 2000s actually, and 33 megahertz, you know. But it, this MP3 blaster program could do downsampling or other things I do not understand in the slightest, but I could listen to MP3s on this ancient piece of kit.
Yeah.
So that was cool anyway.
Yeah.
And, oh, go on, Graham.
No, I was just going to say the easy way to see it is, it's, you know, JPEG from the same kind of motion picture industry has had done exactly the same thing for images. Do you remember when we used to wait for things to load, and JPEG used to load on those dial-up connections, and it used to do it in bands, so you'd get a very low resolution version of the image before and that was so useful when you were using like iBrowse on your Amiga or whatever.
So that's 16 minutes, and we just mentioned the Amiga for the first time. That's pretty good for us. One of my pet peeves at the moment is people using PNGs for photos on the internet. That should be a crime, you know. I like the free and open internet we have, but there needs to be some control, and that needs to be penalized. But the final piece of news in this trio of news tidbits is 250,000 Raspberry Pi Zero Ws have been shipped, at least. I hesitate to say sold, although I'm sure they'll get sold extremely quickly. A quarter of a million Pi Zero Ws. So not just even Pi Zeros, but this more recent Pi Zero. And the Raspberry Pi Foundation, as well as talking about this milestone, said that there are 13 new Raspberry Pi Zero distributors. So it should make it easier to get hold of one. I've got to admit, I haven't bought a Pi Zero myself. The geek part of me wants to. The rational part of me knows I wouldn't use it for much. But are they still really hard to get hold of?
Judging by the fact that they've sold a quarter of a million of them, it sounds like they're a lot easier to get hold of than the original Pi Zeros. I haven't got one either. I've seen them used in all kinds of things, though. I can't find the link right now, but there was a really great project where a group in Bristol, you know, attached stuck a Pi Zero in a tin can and a weather balloon, and you know, launched it from Bristol, and it's somewhere over the middle of France this evening, and it's going to be somewhere over Italy tomorrow, and they're using RF transmissions to track it. And also send, I think it was 300 baud they were getting to be able to send images back from the tin can somewhere over, probably over the Alps by now, back to their Bristol base. And that's you know, it's cool. Brilliant. That's the Raspberry Pi on there.
That is unbelievably cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 300 baud is fine. I think the old Voyager spacecraft, you know, on the edge of interstellar space, on the Helio pause or whatever they call it. I think they're only sending about like 50 baud anyway.
Really?
Sorry, what is baud?
Baud is either bits or bytes per second.
I think it's bits.
It's bits. So eight bits are in a byte, and a byte is a letter. It's a character, basically. And so letters A to Z, numbers. So 300 baud means sending 300 letters, 300 characters per second. You know, which for plain text, that's perfectly fine. No problem there. But sending images. Yeah. That's whether it is bits or bytes, it's very slow. But yeah.
So if the message is, I am on Mars, lol, kisses, there's a plain text message that's going to get there pretty quickly.
Yeah, when our boy Elon sends that, yeah.
But when your boy, Elon sends a selfie, it's going to take a wee bit longer.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And
It's effectively bits. I think Wikipedia says it's the symbol rate or modulation rate. So this is how old modems were judged, by the way that they could really send a signal from -5 to +5 such that, you know, a demodulator could see it, so you could send a piece of data, a piece of information. Yeah, and then when you wrap 8 bits up into a byte and a character, you can see how old bulletin board systems used to load up the screen according to how fast your modem was. And
yeah.
Yeah,
I've got the main thing tempting me to get a Pi Zero is to do some sort of hardware hacking project, like get an old broken Game Boy and you know, a Pi Zero in. I mean, the normal Pi will fit into a lot of old video game cases, but I feel like making some sort of small hand. I've got enough to do, but so I shouldn't even distract myself. But yeah, one day when I'm retired in 85 years.
But at least you don't live in the UK. At least you can retire.
Well, let's see. Yeah, let's see. And unless there's any other items of news, then I think...
No, let's crack on.
Let's progress.
Right. Yes. So...
Over to you, Graham.
The IRC channel, when it comes to fines, it's now time for fines of the fortnight. They're just on fire. I'm sorry to say, if you want to finish your tea. So there are like...
literally on fire.
They're literally on fire. So John the Nice Guy, KeepPass 2 is the mono version of KeepPass, which runs under Linux. It can use almost all Windows plugins for KeepPass. Google Authenticator, KeepFox, which is really cool. So KeepPass is probably the most widely used system for storing all of your passwords in one encrypted place. Very useful, because we should all be using randomly generated passwords for every account we create. It actually becomes easier to do with KeepPass and tools like it. I use Pass. Also from John the Nice Guy, creating Ansible roles for Ansible Galaxy is really easy. Smiley. I don't know. I added to that Picasso 96... the Amiga retargetable graphics system has been sold to a different company. It's no longer going to be developed as a public domain project between the two guys that have maintained it for the last 15 years. It might even be run as a commercial venture by the company that bought it.
This is it. The Amiga's coming back, Graham.
Yeah.
I know. This is the first step.
The Amiga's coming back it reminds you... Oh, God, we're talking about Amiga. But it reminds you what software was like before open source, I must admit, because you expect a lot of this stuff to have been open sourced by now, like Picasso, like Workbench, for example. Workbench is not open source. It's proprietary, and it's still guarded by the company that sells the CD-ROMs.
That doesn't make any sense.
I know.
Why?
Could it be that lots of other companies have... there's a lot of code in there from other parties, and it's hard to get their permission. I seem to remember a while back, so there was some talk about IBM open sourcing OS2.
Yeah.
And I may be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure I saw some quote from an IBM guy saying, well, look, it isn't as easy as that. There's all sorts of code from a million different companies. Okay, IBM should technically own the code, but...
Yeah, well, it took Sun a long time to do both Java and Solaris for exactly those reasons. Years it took to go back through all of the contributions to get people to reassign copyright. I know. But it's not... Workbench isn't even free. And... I don't get it. It's quite ugly. I mean, I love the Amiga, but it's quite ugly that there isn't... You know, with open source and Linux mostly coming after the time that we all use the Amiga, you realise how much you take it for granted that you can, you know, Pac-Man install something or apt install something. It's, you know, the top quality software like Darktable or Blender or something like that. Incredible software.
Yeah, I don't actually really miss much from the Amiga. You know, we talk about it because we like retro geeky stuff.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculously fast for the time for a 7 megahertz processor.
Yeah.
There was a sort of beautiful zen-like minimalism of it. It was pretty easy to use. But yeah, when I think of it, if I tried to use it now, even with, you know, a trillion gigahertz, I'd probably find it quite annoying.
Yeah. It's quite usable, especially from the command line. It's still quite compelling. It's pretty good. It's worth trying. So John the Nice Guy reminds us that Og Camp is on at the 19th and 20th of August 2017 in Canterbury in the United Kingdom.
I should be on the Zugspitze then. I should be on Germany's highest mountain. Maybe dying, but I'm going to try and get up there.
So, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Can
you get a cable car? Are you going to hike all the way?
We're going to hike all the way up, yeah.
How high is it?
It's 2,900 meters, but you start from about 1,200 meters. So
yeah, yeah.
1,700 meters up. We've done some hikes of about 1,000 meters. So But, you know, we're still dumbasses and we'll probably get lost and fall down the mountain.
For comparison, how high is Mont Blanc, do you know?
It's the highest in the world, isn't it? You're just raising your eyebrows at how miniature our our highest mountain is, Andrew.
No, it's a Mont Blanc.
Well, I don't know. I've climbed up Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh several times, and that's about 800 feet, and I was knackered after that. Yeah.
I was going to say, Mike telling us this story did remind me of that scene in Trainspotting. They all go to the train in the countryside.
It's rubbish being European.
Oh, that sounds.
I want to take back control.
that
sounds epic. Canterbury. So, how far away is that from the rest of the UK? It's quite a long way, isn't it?
Philosophically, it's a very long way.
Philosophically, it's probably it's right next door to York, given that the Archbishopric of York is second only in England, in the Church of England, to Canterbury. However, in physical terms, it might take me a wee bit longer than right next door to get there. I might not manage it.
So, right, Old Camp, Enom, a GUI tool called K-Rop Crop with a K. It does just one thing, looks at the pages of a PDF and trims the blank margins down the sides to size. Sounds a bit useless, but it's great for reading PDFs on an e-reader without having to zoom in. I know that problem. I think that sounds like a good tool. I have to have a look
at it. That's a brilliant find. Yeah, because we'll forget about it. But
they're always, there's always so much blank space around the side of those things.
Yeah.
And another one from Enom, get your life recorded by Google on the cheap. DIY Google Home uses the Raspberry Pi and cardboard to make the magic happen. So there's a link, I'll put it in the podcast notes. I guess that's, you don't even have to buy a Google device. You can get Google to spy on you through your Raspberry Pi.
I think if you just exist now, Google spying on you, you don't have to actively do anything.
Somebody says we should mention the Canonical IPO, Anubis Islander, the Red Notebook. It lets you format, tag, and search your entries. You can also add pictures, links, and customizable templates. Spell check your notes. Oh, it's a note-taking app, rednotebook.sourceforge.net. Red Notebook, so it sounds like a notebook, a multimedia notebook. Sounds good, open source diary and journal.
I think I've used it in the past.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I wrote about it for FossPix or the section that had a very similar name in a completely unrelated magazine. I think it's been around for a while. Maybe I'm just getting old and crazy.
So another one from Arubis Islander, Endless OS. Endless OS is an operating system that picks up where Migo and Sugar for the One Laptop Per Child project took off. It's aimed at first computer users who may not always have access to the internet. It comes with loads of information, educational and reference applications that are fully functional offline. And they say they installed it on their old netbook and it worked great. The only drawback was that it was close to impossible to something. The line is cut off at that point. So it's close to impossible to finish a sentence with this. last one from Enom is Zotero. Zotero.org? Designed for researchers and tracking interesting publications citations, but great for collecting any sort of random web pages, document, media data, and organizing it. A bit like bookmarks on steroids and AGPL licensed.
I think you can integrate it with LibreOffice to do bibliographies and stuff like that. I see it often mentioned by LibreOffice users.
Oh, cool.
I have to
give it a go. I quite like the idea of it. Because I use Pocket, and I think I've said before, which I found really useful. But Pocket now being owned by Mozilla isn't such a bad thing in terms of proprietary protocols. But it'd be nice if there was something a bit richer. There isn't a Pocket plugin for Qt Browser, for example, so I have to set up a macro for opening up the Pocket queue and entering a URL to add it to my queue.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, but you can do macros in Qt Browser just like you can on Vim. It's really good.
You should do a tutorial for the Linux Voice section of Linux Magazine.
Simple regex language, simple-regex.com, simple regex language expressions made simple. It's a website that makes regular expressions simple. I think it turns them into a kind of an interpreted language, which is much easier than the Perl-like code that regex is normally made out of.
Oh, I'm sure we've talked about this in the past. Regular expressions are some insanely useful sometimes for just manipulating text, but they look like just gibberish, like you've just smashed your head on the keyboard. And even hardcore card-carrying geeks like us can't get our heads around them.
I know. I wrote a four-page thing on regular expressions, and it's up there in the top five hardest things I ever wrote. You're right. I mean, it'd be interesting to think of what those top five are, but definitely that one. There was, what was that thing? Open Exchange. Do you remember that? Yeah. That's ages. Oh, an auto builder. That would be another one. The auto package, auto builder tutorial that must have been 8-10 years ago now.
Some lovely editor gave you all the best articles to write then, didn't he? I think a while back I had to write a regular expression to parse other regular expressions. Oh. And I thought I either get raised up to another kind of level of existence, another sort of strata of being. I become enlightened at this point or I die.
Yeah.
I guess I'm still here, but I'm not particularly enlightened. Not at all. So.
And I think that may be all. Oh, another one from me and Gogo. I have one that's called Node MCU. It's a Wi-Fi enabled Arduino. And McPhail says he's been having fun with OpenJK. It's yet another open source game engine re-implementation, this time for the Jedi Academy game. I don't know that. I've not used it. And that's it, I think. Which is good timing, because I think Andrew's microphone was playing up then, just as he walked away. It really was. So, we've got any finds? I know we've all been exceptionally busy.
I can say, related to my Zugspitze, not really an anecdote before, but what I was saying, the border between Austria and Germany runs across the top of Germany's highest mountain. It runs across the Zugspitze. So it's the exact border between the two countries. But the height of the mountain in Germany is measured from the North Sea, or from Germany's side, Nordsee. The height of the mountain on the Austrian side is measured from the Adriatic Sea, because of history and fun and games like that. But it means that Germany's highest mountain is actually higher on the Austrian side. So that's a real slap in the face for all Germans and Bavarians, I would say. I'm non-aligned. I'm non-aligned with all this. I've lived in Austria and Germany, so I can...
And you can stand back. You don't have to take it personally. Is there a German word for that? There should be. For being like an alien to a culture and not having to worry about the... You haven't personally invested in its... Well, of course you're invested in its future, but you know what I mean? You don't have to take it personally like we do in other parts of the world.
It's just Gastarbeiter, isn't it?
What does that mean?
Guest worker, yeah. It refers more to...
Who you
to
are.
People who came over in the 60s and 70s. And yeah.
It's a concept that we don't really have in England, because once you're here, you're English.
Just like that.
Absolutely. Just like magic.
Yeah, until we tell you to go home.
Until we say, actually, we're revoking this treaty that was signed in 1973, before you were born. Off you go.
And my other find is that there's a really cool book coming out on the 11th of May.
Good work.
It's called The Haynes Coding Manual. So from Haynes Publishers,
wow.
And all those lovely car books with the exploded engines on the cover. But Haynes is doing a book about Python programming from beginners to sort of immediate, quite advanced stuff. And it was written by one of the people on this podcast.
Great
and Ben's not here, and it wasn't you two, so it's got to be me.
Is it any good?
Well,
or is it rubbish?
Or is it whack? Yeah,
I'm flicking through it now on the Haynes website. It looks awesome.
How many pages are actually on the Haynes website?
Six.
Oh, okay. That's all right.
Wow, that's a funny picture of you. You're wearing a... Wow.
You're wearing a Bavarian set of leather shorts.
Have you seen the picture that they've used of you, Mike? Let me show you.
Let me have a look. Hold on.
I've shared the screen, Andrew.
Oh, sorry. How do I look at that? There we go.
It does look like you've sat on tour.
I'm just so excited and happy about being a book author. Now it looks weird. I do look a bit strange in it, but
you're not taking away from what you've done.
To be fair, like that is absolutely fantastic. It's an awesome achievement. I know that you wrote your guide to Linux and you had the rug pulled out from under you by Ubuntu's GUI change from name to Unity. The wonderful thing about programming languages is that it won't change. So,
well, hopefully not.
Yeah, a guide to Python 3 will be a guide to Python 3 forever.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And you know, programming, the tricks and tips and strategies you learn should be the same. But anyway, I don't want to plug myself too much.
No, no, you
if
must.
If anybody wants to learn Python programming or teach somebody or give it to them, then you can get this book. It's shiny. It's written by me. It's hopefully not got many or any mistakes in it. It will make me happy if people buy it.
That's a great work.
You know, no pressure. No pressure.
That's how. If you look at the Chicago School of monetarist economics, it's all about making people happy.
Yeah. Trickle down the wealth to me, please, rich people.
That's why Pinochet instigated the coup in Chile to make people happy.
Hmm. Meanwhile, those are my finds.
Thank you.
Who says it now?
Shall I go next? So I've got one find, which is I'll cover quickly, but it's a series of audio effects that slot into Pulse Audio, which is different to like normal effects because you can use it while you're doing other Pulse Audio things without using jack. And it's called Pulse Effects. So Pulse Audio being the audio layer. So you can use it when you're listening to music or recording stuff through Hangouts or something like that. My other find is also, I suppose, loosely self-promoting, and that's the YouTube video that I made for the last episode on why I use KDE. It did all right. It's like, 6,700 views now.
Cool.
But loads of people commented on my voice, which I find really weird. There's lots of people who said it had a really relaxing effect. And I was going to read out one comment, and it says like the serenity of the forest spilling into the mirrored shimmer of a glassy secluded mountain lake. I have perhaps unknowingly become the Bob Ross of KDE and Plasma.
Brilliant, you are.
Well, I think what I'm doing is I'm channeling all of those ASMR videos that I watched. Remember, I admitted to you. I think I may have to start up a geek ASMR channel where I describe things and technical things in slow, word heavy pauses. Maybe even whispering like they all do.
I do think, Graham, you have a lovely voice.
Yeah,
and the day that someone commented that you and I sounded like brothers was a. pretty much a high point of my last 37 years.
Well, I don't quite know what to say, but I would actually like to do some more videos, so I think I will if I find some time. It's already been 2 weeks and I've not done anything.
Yeah, you said ASMR, those soft audio things. What you could also do is maybe teach people things in their sleep. So with that gentle voice, teach people regular expressions so they can put their headphones on, go to sleep, and when they wake up, they know.
Yeah, just all I'd have to say actually is GNU's not Unix. GNU's not Unix. GNU's not Unix. GNU's not
my Unix. Linux voice.
So they are my finds.
Okay, my biggest find this week, fortnight, whatever, time is a mere metaphysical concept, really. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't apply to you.
So my big find is that if you go to your GP and say, "Hello GP, I'm finding I'm feeling a bit stressed and worried and finding it hard to sleep and concentrate and have no appetite and have a just worried generally about all sorts of things." They don't laugh at you and tell you to get out because they've got more important things to do. This may come as a revelation to anybody under the aegis of Trump care, but in the NHS, if you go to your doctor and say that you've got various mental difficulties, they don't laugh you out of the room. You will get spoken to and listened to, which is more important than spoken to, and probably referred to the cognitive behaviour therapies, CBT, and given a phone number to ring, which is the gateway, the entry point for all of the mental health treatments available on the NHS. So this has been a marvellous discovery for me. I've not rung the service yet because I've found that a massive cause of stress in my life was my job, which I have left. So I've taken back control, and I'm going to make Andrew great again. But to be honest, just knowing that the service is there is a big help. So knowing that suicide is the biggest killer of men aged under 50, I think. Don't be a soldier. Don't be a brave soldier. Don't try and be hard or anything. Just go to your GP because that's what they get paid for. By the taxpayer, the lazy buggers, they get paid lots of money to listen to the likes of you and me. So go and make them work for their money. There we go. That's my primary discovery slash find. The other one is that being unemployed is maybe a bit scary, but not as scary as being in a job that you hate. Yeah, so there we go. There's a moral for all of us there.
Do you get longer than 5 minutes? Because that always worries me about the doctor. They always, when I go, it's like, well, hey, how many problems are you complaining about here? You know, I've got bad back, and you know, I've also got a problem with my shoulder that I really should have told you about last time.
I just think a bad back is, you know what? Last time when I went with my back, she just looked me up and down and said, "Well, you're quite tall, so." You will probably get a bad back. Like, what? I'm 6 foot nothing. I'm well within the middle of that bell curve of humanity. I'm not quite tall. I'm just a standard issue human being. Like, don't give me this nonsense.
You should never have got up a full fours. That's what it is.
Yeah. What do I do about that?
Well, I actually, not to joke about it, I think it's a really good thing to say. I've had some experience with the mental health system in this country, and it has been excellent, and the people who help and the people who are there to help are wonderful, dedicated people who just care about you getting better.
Yes, and I'm sure if Ben were here, he would have something to say about this as well. But I also have I have known people who have gone through the system, and people have cared very strongly about, and I wish that they had done so sooner, because you live with somebody who's going through any like mental difficulties, and then as soon as they get seen, it's like living with a different person.
Yeah,
they just become more like themselves again. So, I mean, knowing what we know about computer science and geeks, and you know, we tend to keep ourselves to ourselves, but really don't do it, because your taxes pay their wages, and when you're in the waiting room, make sure that you remind them that.
I'm sure that gets you better treatment, yeah. Shouting that at them.
It does. It's like when you go to the Czech Republic and you shout at people in German. They just respond more promptly.
Whether positive or negative.
Yeah, in all seriousness, yeah, just do it. Don't feel like an idiot. Just go and talk to somebody, because they are the professionals, and they can help.
Thank you, Andrew. I think they are our finds, which I know what the next bit's going to be.
It's the halfway reminder. We are halfway through this podcast, and that means that still to come, we have the neurons, which may or may not be vocalised by the Pavarotti of South Bavaria, Mike Saunders. Or is it Oberbayern? Unterbayern?
Oberbayern. Bavaria.
Oberbayern. Yeah. Upper Bavaria.
It's to do with the rivers, you see. We are upstream on the Danube River. So we've got Lower Bavaria, Niederbayern, that's downstream on the Danube River.
Isn't it on the Isar?
Munich is, yeah, but Munich is the city inside Oberbayern, Upper Bavaria. Upper Bavaria is a big region, big chunk of people.
Okay, cool. So with that in mind, we still have the vocalize your neurons, and also the voice of the masses. Right, Mike, over to you.
Right. Here are the neurons to vocalize. There are no neurons. We've had some great neurons in the past, listeners, so email me, send in your things, not 500,000 lines of XML, but if you have something to say, you've got a discovery or a find, in which case I'll just steal it for the finds. But if you want to vent your spleen, you want to get something out, you want to talk about something cool, send a shortish email to me, mike@linuxvoice.com. Say it's a neuron in the subject line, and within certain guidelines, I'll read it out.
I've got a theory on this. I think we've alienated around 52% of the people who like to express their feelings.
You mean whenever I complain about XML?
No, I think in general, over the course of the podcast.
Can we alienate 35% of French people as well?
Yeah.
Because those people, I don't mind alienating them. They can just go away.
But let us know which distro you use for statistical purposes.
Maybe that's the next voice of the masses. Which distro?
Well, it's got a cheeky wee red, black, or white colour scheme.
To add some balance, we've looked at Red Star OS.
True.
We're the BBC of podcast broadcasting. Which distro would Nigel Farage use?
So it's time for our next section, which will be quasi non-political. Voice of the masses, that it be. I should interject at this point and say, if you want to subscribe to a print version of this utter nonsense, you should go to linuxmagazine.com and buy our words. In the upcoming issue 200 of Linux... 200? Good Lord. Issue 200 of Linux Magazine, in the Linux Voice section, we have a feature on starting your own FOSS project. Who wrote that?
Me.
Wow! In that case, it's probably worth reading. One aspect that we focus on is the name. What should you call your new app or game? Quirky names are okay, but there are some pretty dodgy examples in the FOSS world. One example is GIMP, a great app, a flagship open source project, but with a name that makes it very hard to sell to people. Which leads us to this podcast question: should GIMP be renamed? And if so, what to? Are there any other projects which desperately need rebranding? Right, I'm going to leap now to Paul Figueredo, who says absolutely it should be renamed. At a certain point, any open source project has to move on from being a niche replacement to something that is taken seriously in professional circles. They have to do this in order to hopefully draw more funding and maintain or increase feature parity with their proprietary cousins. Inkscape and Critter are the two that come to mind that are doing the most successfully at the moment. It's a parasitical relationship in some regard. In order to be taken seriously in professional adoption, you have to approach feature parity, but in order to have the time and funding to approach feature parity, you have to court the professional adoption. GIMP, as it stands, has been comparatively stagnant in that regard. There has been some movement recently towards 2.10, but even that has been nearly a decade in coming. Meanwhile, Inkscape, Critter, Scribus, and a host of others are lapping them in terms of development and at least a small level of professional adoption. Am I saying it's the name that's holding it back? Not necessarily, but a rebranding is required to get it back into people's consciousness after spending a decade now in slow development obscurity. Now, Paul, as far as I'm concerned, is absolutely right and has the last word. Can anybody else convince us otherwise?
No, I think he's right. I think there are a lot of factors that we don't necessarily understand about the GIMP. The fact that for a long time it was just two people developing it, that it's always been underfunded. It's a little bit like the open cert or the certificate, oh God, what was it? Where only a couple of people are working on such an important project.
OpenSSL.
Thanks, OpenSSL. Thanks,
yeah, Mike. The Heartbleed thing.
Yeah, and I suspect they hear criticism about the name all the time, but at the same time, they're just so woefully underfunded and they don't have the time or the ability to do anything more than maintain it. And that's despite the fact that all of us still use it in some way to do some essential editing. And I think it's really, the name is wrong. We talked about this years and years ago. I remember the GNOME screen grabber called Scrot. And, you know, there's a tendency for OS projects to have names like this. But GIMP is, and especially was, important enough to have a proper proper nurturing community and a council that would have, you know, should have and would have, could have guided it past its initial GIMP naming and turned it into something more recognizably modern along with the OS. And I think more, so I think if we want, more important than changing GIMP's name in particular, the project needs our support.
I do think it is renaming. I've recently broken out of the bubble of working with free software / programming people, and I was within a room of real human beings. We were talking about pixel art and through some other web-based application and GIMP, and you know, a laugh went around the room when GIMP word was mentioned, because it doesn't matter how fast you can run when you're running away from a bear. You don't have to outrun the bear, you have to outrun the slowest member in your party. So GIMP may well be enormously technically proficient, but when MailChimp already gives you the opportunity to resize, adjust brightness and color in the browser, you just don't need GIMP, and giving it such a stupid name makes it a harder sell. Moylan says, this pops up every few years. The name is unimportant. If it were, they'd rename Scunthorpe. The main problem with GIMP is that it has a vertical learning curve. Vim is to Nano as GIMP is to MS Paint. And Moylan says that without using the shift key at all.
Maybe he's doing it in Vim.
Maybe he's doing it in Vim. Maybe, I really don't know. But to be honest, presentation does matter. It really, really does matter. Mike says, yes, I usually like quirky names, but GIMP is an awful name. It hurts my Linux pride. I can't think of a nice name. The only thing that springs to my mind is Mage. It has a bit of the word image in it, and it evokes the magic that GIMP can do. A few of the GIMP defenders further below the line say that English is not their first language. English is a lot of people's first language, and it's a lot of software buyers' first language. And if it's not your first language, chances are that it is your second language. Dale McGee, who says no, and that's it. No, GIMP should not be renamed. Not GCHQ Honest says, I wasn't aware of the disabled connotations of the word GIMP, only the BDSM, sex slave pulp fiction portrayal. Either definition doesn't really help introduce the product to new people. I quite like Mage, as suggested by Mike. So, hang on, there was quite a long... Anyway, I think basically some people think that GIMP should be renamed, and they are correct, and some people think that GIMP should not be renamed, and they're wrong.
I think actually you made a really interesting point. I've been thinking about it, that maybe the reason why, despite GIMP being so brilliant and powerful, and also it was this powerful back in 2004 when 2.0 was released, is the fact that the name may have definitely held it back from wider adoption, despite the fact that it was rivaling Photoshop, which at the time cost hundreds of pounds. Yeah,
and also in terms of getting support, I mean, you know, with a different name, a rebranding, maybe if they then took in donations, you know, I really don't know the download stats for GIMP, but I suspect it's not up there with Firefox and co. But you know, it's a tool plenty of people use on Windows and Mac as well. Get a new name, a bit of rebranding, make that part of it, make it fun, you know, the community chose the name, well, to some extent, and then have a nice donate page on the site, show people where it's going. You know, that's what Mozilla guys do, I think, and LibreOffice we do, and say, look, this is where the money's going. We want to make this program better. So, yeah, that may be the solution.
Yeah.
Wonderful. The name is not just the sole problem with GIMP. I think it's the primary problem, but there are other considerations, and it does raise other issues, you know, for the rest of free software. How do we name things? Is GScrot a sensible name for an application? I would argue not. Is MicOS a sensible name for an enterprise level, scalable cloud silo leveraging business OS, probably not.
Andrew, zero vulnerabilities in the wild. How many other systems can boast that? You've got to take this stuff seriously.
Yes, but that really brings us to the end, I think, of this podcast. Hopefully, fingers crossed, next time we will have Ed Sheeran with us.
Cool.
Can write us all the song. Because I think if Ben is Ed Sheeran, then the rest of us are Taylor Swift.
I've got a theory that Ed Sheeran is basically the Phil Collins of this generation.
That's wonderful. I love it. The next time I'm being interviewed for BBC, I will spout that and pass it off as my own. So, until then, thank you everybody for listening. I've been Andrew Gregory. These two have been Nameless Drones, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.